as I walked off, this wee guy come up and said, "Do you want to come play for Clyde?" And I'm sorry, right, I'm doing a degree. I'm not really can't do that. They want to be a professional if I don't want to give up my degree. They went, "Well, we're part time. You could play part time with us, and it wouldn't affect your degree." I went, "Oh, well, what do you mean part time?" He goes, "You know, train Tuesday night, Wednesday night, or maybe Thursday, game on Saturday. Won't get in the way of your studies." And I went, "Sure." He said, "We can pay you 35 quid a week. Where's the pen?" He said, "How many albums can I buy for 35 quid a week?" And all this time, I'm yeah. And he said, "You could get up to 100 quid a week if you know if you're in the team and you if you can win games, win bonuses." And I went, "Oh, that's interesting. That's good, but I mean, I'm not much chance of getting in the team." And he just said, "Well, you've just dribbled around half of them. That was the first team you were playing against there and scored a goal." I went, "All right, okay." So anyway, that man, of course, was Craig Brown.
Welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually for Turnhill. I'm your host, Ian Stephen. And for today's episode, we meet a man who was forged in the banks of the Clyde, who was straddling the Thames and the Mersey in a glittering 20-year playing career. The football makes an award-winning literary career, means I'll shut up and he'll be able to write anything far more scintillating to this intro than I could myself. It's Pat Nevin. Pat, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. I've grown up to being a wee bit tired at the moment. There's a lot going on in a very short period of time. Always happens like this, doesn't it? Currently, a book out this week, as in the paperback, the Euros, daughter getting married in 2 weeks' time, and I'm DJing for two nights' time, a mad thing. Only to be told that the tech that I use isn't available. So I'm going to have to DJ without any music, which is interesting. Anyway, in simple terms, life throws up questions. You know what? Just a bit of fun to find the answers.
Two questions that immediately spring up from that part. Number one, can we take point one and point two and merge them together so we get people to buy your book and read it on the way to the Euros? That would be the perfect kind of accompaniment, don't you think?
You know, the weird thing is, actually, it's a very strange thing. You know, you start writing, like, you know, I've written a couple of books in the last 3 years or so, and people send you pictures of it on, you know, X or whatever. The most common thing is someone's, they send pictures of, they're on holiday reading your book. And you're like, I never thought of that when I was writing this stuff. It's holiday stuff. Every bit, and I think, wow, that's really interesting. So then people start to send me pictures of the book in weird places, on beaches or whatever. They did that with the first book, and they started doing it now with this second one as well. So certainly the case, if you're at Euros, there's football in both books. That's still football. It's the first one, second one, football and how to survive it. And certainly definitely Scotland stuff in both of them as well, which kind of nice, kind of fits a wee bit, I think.
Well, the other question, your daughter getting married, does the father approve? Did you endorse this union?
I mean, really good. Well, yeah, it's one of those things you kind of be light about it, but I mean, some people, their daughters get married and there's a question mark and you're not sure, and there's a then star. This day's complete wow. It's like, top gazer. Both of them are doctors, you know, far cleverer than thickos like me. But just perfect for each other. And it's, isn't that a great feeling? And so you're blessed. So for all complaints about anything else, anyway, you might have, that's what you want above everything else, for your children to do okay. And she looks as if she's taking all right.
Well, I have to confess, when I do the research for these episodes, it's usually articles from Bill Miller and the Sun, for your own brown stuff. But for you, I had to brush up on quantum mechanics, epistemology, orphism, philematology, 1980s indie pop music. I've got no idea what direction this episode is going to go in. I'm poking fun at you a little bit here, but do you think figures in the game avoid you because you're perceived as being highly intelligent from what is, I don't know if this sounds very true, but footballers are not held regarded as the kind of top echelons of the intellectual society, and rightly or wrongly, I mean, a lot of them are. But do you think a lot of figures in the game were intimidated by you, or are still intimidated by you?
Well, they didn't avoid me. We didn't always share the same interests out with it, but I ask a question. Anyone who's listening or watching, you know, you go to work, do you share the interests of everybody at your work? Well, no, we don't, do you? Scott, it's just going to work. You know, and I got on with the players at a certain level, and some of them became friends. Others didn't. There is out with the actual sport, there's a kind of ideal that footballers are supposed to behave and the things supposed to be interested in, but it's not necessarily strictly true that they're all like that. They're just a cross-section of lads. I would push back on the concept that they're not the brightest. I think they've got street smarts as a general group. They're pretty good at that. I always just remember, you know, lots of my friends were journalists, you know, and I actually had more friends with journalists than were players, or sometimes the sports guys. And sometimes you'd hear the odd kind of sniffy, or you'd feel the odd sniffy attitude towards the players. And I always used to think, see if you could survive within a dressing room, by the way. And I don't think you could. You'd be doing well, because it's a vicious place and it's a hard place. And it's also a sharp place as well. So I got my side of it for, you know, being slightly different in certain ways. And that's what made it easy to write, because I was feeling slightly voyeuristic from the outside looking in, because I'd had this different background. I'd studied, I'd been doing a degree, you know, and kind of turned down football for quite a long time before I, you know, eventually get dragged into it. So then the usual background into it. But the big thing that really does help is if you're from a kind of west of Scotland, i.e. Glasgow, Easterhouse background, you're not going to get bullied. You know, bullies, you've seen bullies before. You can see that what they do and why they do it and how they try and do it. You just don't. So the classic example being, you know, nicknamed Weirdo when I went to Chelsea. And I was thinking, yeah, well, I think I'm normal. You lot are weird because I have interest in different things. And I think lots of people have. But the weirdo stuff, people always think, you get abuse for that. Nah, not at all. It was all right. It was done with fun. And it's an easy line. And it's a line that was often trotted out, and often is trotted out. It was never a problem, and never a massive problem.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
Yeah, so brought up in Easter House, Nathan at Glasgow, you know, such kids.
You went to Luke's Heads? Whereabouts?
When I said, four in the real. So it was three brothers and two sisters. My mum and dad lived in a tenement in Easter House. Funnily enough, my memory, because we left Easter House. Yeah, this is great, because sometimes you get things online and somebody said, he's talking rubbish. He wasn't in Easter House. He was in Ballina. You know, thinking, yeah, I was in Ballina. I moved there when I was 10. I think I might know my history. Well, it's something you matey. Right when you're eight, somebody says, you're making that up, but you're quite clearly you arse. So I didn't even answer that. Anyway, so I had a great time. But there was only two. But one thing I got wrong is I thought it was three bedrooms. It wasn't. So the four boys in one room, two girls in the other room, and mum and dad, and it's like the couch. So, oh God, yeah, the terrible time you must have had. We had a great time. I loved it. Brothers and sisters, friends, playing football all the time, as I was said, being a young kid. And so, man, really happy time. The most important things about that. And it's funny, this is maybe a really key part. When you look back in your life, you're a footballer, when you've been a footballer, even if you were kind of accidental or kind of dragged into it to some degree, not because I didn't love it, purely because I would keep loving it and didn't want it to be my sheer full-time job all the time, which will destroy the love of it. But when you've done it and you've been indoctrinated to some degree, you realise that you never look back. So it's a guilty pleasure looking back. So I found myself getting to my 50s before I thought, better have a real look back at that. Aye. A guilty pleasure. Because in football, if you look back, you're living in the past. Move forward. And I suppose my desperate love is music. And I kind of slightly wary looking back then as well, because I wanted the next new thing, the next new thing, the next new thing. Try and get new music that I loved. Something I haven't heard before. But there, you have to come to one point where you think, I shall look back. And looking back at those things you ask about, and then, you know, growing up in the East End of Glasgow, I loved it. I was really, really happy. Used to go to Celtic all the time. They were a great team. They wished to win everything. Started going to see bands when I was kind of my teens.
Yeah.
Another pure love and joy. And I had a school that was very, very helpful. Great teachers. You know, if you were interested, which I was, in literature, you were pushed and you were helped. So I'm afraid the violins with a small tenement flat in Easter House and loads of us get the violins away. It was great fun for me. How well did.
I'll bring the violins straight back out again here, Pat. The 1970s Glasgow, for some reason, football scouts all thought that they needed to hurry up the next Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and anybody under the height of 6'8" was discounted as being too small. Was anybody ever stupid enough to make that assertion to you?
That's been true. I've said loads. Wait, no, I was actually a Celtic S form, the Celtic Boys Club player. So they brought me in, and I'd done well, and it looked like Celtic would sign me. And they, in the end, amongst all the things, said, look, you're probably not big enough and you're not going to make it, a bit scrawny. And when I was 16, what they didn't know is that I wouldn't have accepted a contract anyway, because I was quite to a degree. But yeah, I mean, that's the sort of thing where, again, you want the violins out, but I'm afraid they're not there. Because when I was told I was too wee and I wouldn't make it at Celtic, I went, yeah, fair enough, that's all right. You know, I'm going to get a degree anyway. I wasn't thinking of being a footballer for Celtic. And I know it sounds weird, I know it sounds odd, but people who have known me long enough knew that I had a different background. So I had three older siblings who'd all went on to higher education. So I wasn't thinking along the lines where everybody else was thinking, well, I've got to be a footballer. I was thinking, no, you go into a sensible job or you go into higher education. That's what you do. So I kind of made that sort of decision. So if you want to call me 2E or think knows they're in, I don't care. I just got to do what I wanted to. And I will admit, it was a concern for my dad, because my dad had trained me. He was a good coach. I'd worked so long with him, you know, to develop my skills. But I was doing it because I liked doing it. Wasn't doing it so I could be famous. So I felt bad for him, because he was a Celtic man as well. And, you know, and I'd been signed as an S-form. And of course he must have had it in the back of his mind. But, you know, being Scottish, it was a bit of let me go, Dad. All right, then. Slapping it. All right, move on. That's it. There was no big violins and gear. So I die. Bloody life to live.
It sounds so counterintuitive for Celtic to say that, because the best player, pretty Dalglish, you could argue, was Jimmy Johnston. And there's no rationale for it. And I feel bad for Scottish basketball between the 80s and 90s. They didn't have any tall players. They were all rubbish footballers.
Jim Morrison was quite good. I liked him. Who did he play? He played for the Murray International Mail. Hey, knowledge of basketball in the 80s. Hey, come on. The only reason is because Jim Morrison was one of my best mates in college. Still is one of my best friends as well. To be honest, all that side of it, we'd like to think that way. Celtic in the end tried to come back and tried to buy me four times in my career. So, you know, people don't always get everything right, as it were.
The Clyde famously meanders its way through Glasgow. How did you meander your way to Clyde?
So at Clyde, I was playing boys' club football because, as I say, I didn't necessarily want to be professional, but I loved playing. So I was playing with my mates up at a team called Jack Cosh United. And it was just great fun. So I'd go and see, you know, my team Celtic the weekend, and then go and play with Jack Cosh Sunday usually. And we played a whole season where we were not to beat us, we were just hammering everyone. And it was an under-18 side as it were at the time. So I was just 16, 17. And we ended up playing a bounce game. Our manager had been asked if we could provide a team for Clyde reserves down at Shawfield to play against then. And me and my mate had a bet for the game. He said, whoever scores the best goal buys the other one an elbow. which is the only betting I ever do, my left. And anyway, I beat him at four and scored, beat Cuba. He scored for about 25 yards. And Brian and I were walking off. This is Brian Sweeney. We were walking off after the game. And I'm going, my goal was better than yours. And he's going, no, it's not. Mine's just 25 yards. He's doing all that stuff. And as I walked off, this week, guy came up and said, do you want to come play for Clyde? And I'm sorry, man. I'm doing a degree. I'm not really, can't do that. They want their professional. If I don't want to give up my degree, He went, well, we're part time. You could play part time once. It wouldn't affect your degree. I mean, oh, well, doing part time goes, you know, between Tuesday night, Wednesday night, maybe Thursday, game on Saturday, won't get in the way of your studies. I went, if you do that, he said, we could pay you 35 quid a week. Where's the pen? Can you fit? How many albums can I buy for 35 quid a week? And all this time, and he said, you could get up to 100 quid a week if you're in the team and you, if you to win games, win bonuses. And I went, oh, that's interesting. That's good. But I mean, I'm not much chance of getting in the team. And he just said, well, you've just dribbled round half of them. That was the first team you ever played. It's going to be global. I went, all right, okay. So anyway, that man, of course, was Drake Brown. And, you know, and in that moment, someone who wasn't going to have a career in football, suddenly it came. And for 2 years, a year and a half, yeah, it's 2 years, two seasons, I played part-time for Clyde. And it all went a bit weird because I was trying to do a degree. But everything, as hard as I tried, everything kept on going right. Kind of. And it's kind of, Chelsea came in and tried to buy me. And I said, no. So, which surprised quite a lot of people. And I went, no, I don't want to, no, it's not bad. Don't want to leave, I'm happy. We win the league. I win player of the division. Remember, I'm only 17, you know, and I'm trying really hard not to be noticed after a week in India. It's just everything. I mean, went to play in the Euros for the Scotland under-18s. Quietly, didn't tell anyone on the course. Win the tournament, got player of the tournament, scored in the final. Just think, this is not really working here. This is all going slightly wrong, stroke right. So it was kind of weird time. But it was brilliant as well, because I was really happy. Playing football, more and more clubs were coming to watch. Spurs were coming to watch, I was told, etc. Dundee United were trying to buy us. Celtic came back into watches as well. And of course, I'm away doing a marketing thing or a economics accounts a lot. So, stop annoying me. Did you see that in the theatre? So it's kind of a weird existence for that period of time. But in the end, kind of folded after a couple of years and decided to, okay, I'll do it. I'll go to Chelsea and just take 2 years down there. And the joke is, the only reason or the best reason to do it was not the money. It actually turns out to be... you get a bit more gigs in London than you do in Glasgow. I mean, Glasgow was great for gigs. And I've seen plenty, but in London, everybody goes to London. So, hey, 2 years down there, they're paying me. I'll take that. So I took a sabbatical for the last year to the year of the degree. And that 2 year sabbatical now turned into 1 year, I think.
Well, you touched upon one of the kind of maybe the greatest and maybe one of the most unsung figures in Scottish football, other than Craig Brown. In my opinion, I thought he was an outstanding figure in Scottish football. What was your memory of the great man, especially at Clyde?
He's good wisdom. Good wisdom. The technical stuff and all that, you do all that at lab, you learned all that. That's fine. Craig was a kind of lecturer anyway. He knew all that stuff. So good enough at that. Could spot a player, which is, you know, an undervalue that some managers are better than others at. He was good at it, and very good at it. In fact, I can only tell you the personal side of it. And the personal side of it was, he left me alone. Yeah, you just go and do your thing. You know, he kind of often used to say, because I didn't like playing the wing, I'd never played in the wing, and he wanted me to play in the wing a bit. And I said, I'm more of a striker or a 10. And he'd say, look, start there, but then just go. So like a bit like if you watch David Silver over the years, and quite a lot of modern wide players, they're not wingers, are they? So that was exactly what I was trying to explain to him, and he explained to me. actually, you are a forward. You've got two other guys who will be up there, but you're the one that creates and moves and finds space and sort of understands the game a little bit. And he understood my game intelligence, match intelligence, which is the most important thing you can have if you're going to be a top player. And the fact that he trusted and believed in that when I was like 17, pretty good, you know, just threw us in fairly quickly. I was lucky I scored a lot of goals and made a lot of goals really quickly when I started playing with Clyde. And he just had that understanding. And it was driving me nuts because he didn't put me in the first team right away. And I was like, after about 2 weeks, I'm going, he's again. What again? And eventually it did. It was only a couple of months in. But those first couple of months were driving me nuts because I thought I can do something. So anyway, I scored a six in the first six and then stayed in the team after that. And he never, ever, ever had a cross with me. Never once. And all the time. So Scotland with him. And over the years, done great things. I mean, he played picking for Scotland. Scotland when he was assistant manager. And he was just constantly, constantly helpful. But if he trusted somebody was trying to do the right things, he loved me too. And if he thought somebody was arsing about, he'd tell them. You know, absolutely tell them. But that sort of wisdom and that sort of kindness, it was just always there with me. And the thing that, after he passed, the thing that really jumped out, everyone was telling the stories about, oh, he did this for me, he did that for me, did this for me, did that for me. And it was just a list that everybody talked to. Craig done something for him. Off his own back, for no reason. Just do it. Do the right thing. And that above everything else. Even though great Scotland manager, all that sort of stuff. That's why I love the guy. Absolutely why I love the guy. Because he did that for everyone. And I can tell you lots and lots of things he did for me. And I hopefully tried to do things I'm by. But we had a mutual friend called George, who this guy who had been a biffed up with younger, you know, very difficult. He's lived around the corner from me where Barlanet. And you would see Craig up there at his house. Or me, Billy McNeil would be at his house. And we'll not do these things. Craig would do that way, not just George, but he'd do that with hundreds of people. Just go.
You also talked about the championships as well. I think it was Scotland's first ever international tournament. And you talked about being the player of that tournament. I'll drop in a couple of names of other players that were playing in that tournament. Portugal had Paulo Futre and the Netherlands with Marco van Basten. So, I mean, that's pretty good company to be winning a player of the tournament then.
And the funny thing is, here's a truthful thing. You know, football fans might not know this. You don't look at the opposition, you don't care. I don't anyway. Never did. The amount of things people say to me, oh, you must have played against so-and-so, you know, or, you know, Glenn Hoddle, and I'm thinking, did it? I can't remember. Gaza, I might have done, yeah. You don't, you're concentrating what you need to do. And you're right, I didn't know Futre was playing, but it was young man at the time, Van Basten. We knew that the Dutch were good, but we got a draw against them, which was pretty handy. So there was decent players, there always is, coming through. What was surprising really is that from our group, there was a group that came through around about that time for that championships and the one after it in the Worlds was staggeringly big amount of players made it through top level. Really huge number. And a huge number went on and played international. It's kind of unusual. Usually an under-18s international, very few. Yeah, if one gets through, well done. You know, we had loads of them for that little group. You know, for that group, I remember playing with Brian McClure. He didn't get there because he was doing something else. Eric Lai, he was playing in Europe with Sir Alex Ferguson. He ended up playing international football. And Gary McKay.
Bruce Well, I think, Paramount didn't use in the cup final.
McKay as well, yeah. And he started looking through all the players that ended up being internationals. So I think Paul McStay, obviously. So it was a right good gang of players that we had at that time, and it was good. Then it was the fact that we beat some good teams, and it was lovely because recently I made a documentary about it, about finding the footage of that game, and it's just really moving. Let's get back to that thing I was saying before, you never look back. It's a guilty pleasure, because if you look back, it's as if you've accepted defeat and you've run the way back down. But looking back on that was really meaningful, because for a number of those players, it was maybe the highlight of their careers. For others, I mean, Andy Roxby, who was a manager at the time, for ages and ages afterwards, he used to wear a number 16 shirt because that's the shirt I wore. That tournament, it was so important to him that it gave him the big lift, push forward. He'd won that tournament and he got the ball through the SFA and further on. And it was lovely because he liked my style. I think he liked my style of play.
So when you went to Chelsea in 83, were you basically just thrown in and left to your own devices to get settled in? Was London quite daunting?
London wasn't as daunting as it would be for a lot of people. Coming from a big city like Glasgow, it helps. I'd been doing a degree for 2 years, so I felt as if I could take care of myself, although I was still living at home where I was in Glasgow. I'd travelled quite a bit. The year before, I'd interrailed around Europe, as you do as a student. I'd been through London and went to a bunch of gigs in London when I'd been through. So, you know, it was going down and I was kind of on my own quite a bit right at the start. So, you know, there was, you have to sort things out, but I kind of, you're young, you're adventurous, you're looking forward to it. It should be fun. We're going to pay you some money to go and kick a ball there. The expectations were incredibly low. So at the start, one of the big things was I was skint, absolute skint, for the first few month or so, because I was on 180 quid a week. So you pay tax 60, as it was at the time, so about 100 quid. 50 or 60. And rent was 100 quid a week. So I've got 20 quid left for the week. Feed myself. So it wasn't easy, you know, right at the start. You know, I had a wee bit of savings. It was a period of time where I was better off as a student than I was as a signed for Chelsea. And then, because I was, you know, really struggling at that first little period and I was almost losing money. So I couldn't really go out anywhere, but I didn't really want to because I wanted to do, try and get myself fit. So I was doing what I always did, which was, you know, go to training, then running in the evening. So I'm going long runs and stuff like that. Keep myself in good nick, do an afternoon training on my own. But there was no other life to it. You know, I had a telly so I could watch Cheers. And that's fine. I could read books. I could listen to John Peel show. That was kind of my hobbies and interests at the time. So my hobbies and interests weren't expensive. I wasn't able to afford to go to see that many bands. There was a couple of bands at the time, right at starting time in Chelsea, that I wanted to go and I didn't have the money to go. Nothing, because it's always stuck by me, you know, that I missed them. But I caught them later. So the first period, yeah, it wasn't particularly easy, but then why should it be? You know, you've gone down, they've spent some money on me. I'm very young at this point, 19, 18, 19. And the expectations are that if I push it, I might get into the team in a couple of years' time. And that was the kind of thinking from most suspect, and certainly the players down there. They just thought I was this wee, skinny, scrawny kid, which I was. Who talked with his weird accent and kind of talked with funny words and sat in the corner reading books. And they thought, what's he doing here? But they were all right, lads. They were okay. And two or three of them were really good, became good friends quite quickly because when they made the attempt to chat, you realised that the surrealist comedian types, I got on with them, you know, the Python-esque ones, we got on together. And slowly but surely, you just introduce yourself to the group. You don't go in all guns blazing. I was quite quiet in those days. And the most important thing was, if you in a football environment show that you can play, you get respected, full stop. So you make sure you can play. And that's what I can try to do quite quickly.
Well, for people that are younger, that are listening, they probably associate Chelsea as being obligar. Billionaires playing, challenging for the Champions League every season. When you went at Chelsea, that wasn't the case. They were very nearly relegated down to the third tier of English football. Was it a very, very different Chelsea club than what it is now?
Yeah, I mean, some bits are actually the same. There's some people still working there that worked there at the time. The main stand is still the main stand. But yeah, I mean, the year before I went, they nearly went down to the third tier. So they bought myself from three or four other players, and with a view to making sure that never happened again. They kind of went a wee bit better than they thought very quickly. So they'd been a top team in the 70s. When we arrived, myself, Kerry Dixon, Joe McLaughlin, Ed Sweeney, Spackman, etc., they were struggling. But all five of us immediately got in the first team, immediately changed the kind of attitude. The manager had basically half a new team. And then suddenly, from a team that was kind of struggling, it went extremely well, very, very, very quickly. I mean, really staggeringly, like, as in first game, 5-0 league, although I wasn't playing that. And so, yeah, they'd been a big, big club. They'd won European trophies. They'd won the FA Cup in the 70s. And by the time it was the early 80s, they're shambles. They're a mess. They're financially wrecked as well. They bought 5 of us for £500,000. Not 8. 5 of us for £500,000. It's extraordinary. You build a whole team for that small amount of money. And it's okay. It felt a little bit of money then, but it still, even got the team, that was nothing. That was bad at the time. So, you know, and often if kids say now, and they ask about, you know, playing for Chelsea, etc., you know, if I, with the financial side of it, if I say, well, I played for Chelsea for 5 years, I was player of the year twice, I worked for them for nearly 20 years, doing writing for them and doing TV stuff for them as well. And if you add everything I ever earned up all together, comes to about 2 weeks of a current player's wages. Yes, in answer to your question, it's changed a wee bit, absolutely. But, you know, some of the fan base didn't for a long, long time. And, you know, what is a club other than its fans? That's the way I think about it. And that was certainly the reason why I had an affection with that group, because a group of the fans were brilliant to me. There were a small group of the fans that I didn't like at all. And I was very clear and very open about that. And, you know, and spoke constantly about it. But yes, it's a different club. I'll be honest with you, every club is a different club now.
I think it's important to note that it should be applauded to speak out against some of the behaviours of certain fans. I don't think that's done enough in football. I think if anything, that sort of bigotry takes place, I think teammates should just walk straight off the pitch and refuse to play.
Problem is that can be misused. That's the difficulty. As soon as you say, right, we'll walk off. Well, all you needed is a bad actor at this event. Okay, let's start shouting something, we'll all walk off. And, you know, what about the kid who's waited and spent all his money to go and travel all that way and watch a game of football? And who's actually won there? So I get it. I get why it's intolerable and it shouldn't be tolerated. I prefer just singling those people out and either arresting them or kicking them out. I'm big on that. If it's large numbers of people, yeah, you can just stop again. Yeah, you have to stop again. And that's what happens there in certain areas in football. But the difficulty is bad actors can use this. Yeah, all you need is one person who thinks that their belief is bigger than everything else. So they shout it out to stop the game to make their point. And then everyone's joy and everyone's pleasure is ruined. And unintended consequences, beware of them. But as you will be aware that we've got CCTV cameras now. We've got people that are spotting, you know. And I don't want to live in, 1984, George Orwell. But, you know, the hatred and particularly the bigotry and particularly racism or sexism, and just no place for it. But it's becoming much less of a problem now than it certainly was then. But we don't leave it go. We keep on going at it and try to educate as much as we can, and that's what I try to do as well.
Well, we're not going to leave bitter hatred alone, Pat, because the run that you had at the start, he's in Derby County, former champions of England, saw 5-0, writing on Melbourne, the Premier League, Blackburn Rovers, or Premier League, Sheffield Wednesday, one of the biggest clubs in England, in October, Fulham Derby, one of the most bitter rivalries in English football. What can you tell us about playing? Everybody talks about the Old Firm. They talk about, you know, Arsenal, like Spurs. What about Fulham and Chelsea? I've not really heard much about that.
You don't actually care. But when There's no bad feeling. They're just around the corner for each other, but they weren't. Chelsea never thought they were really of their standard for most of the years. Almost seen as a nice wee brother kind of thing. The real hatreds, Chelsea, Arsenal, Chelsea Spurs particular, and Arsenal Spurs. That's the real. And then West Ham's got a bad throw towards Chelsea. So all them have. Fulham's all right. Oddly enough, it was a big one for me because I thought I'd take a long time getting into the team, but it was only a few games. It was only four or five games, I think. I'd been on the bench twice already, hadn't gone. And then come on against Gillingham in the cup. There was a game against Sheffield Wednesday away from home where I started. That was my first start. And then that was it. Never out of the team again. So for some days, a wee, you know, wee kid just sneaking in the back door, utterly unexpected to do anything. I got my first game and then kept my place for the rest of my time at Chelsea, basically, which surprised a lot of people, even maybe the manager as well, who rated me highly. But so by the time we got to the Fulham game, which was a couple of weeks later, it was still the start of the season, beautiful lush green pitch, very open game. It ended up 5-3 to Chelsea, and it kind of nailed what we were then going to become, because Kerry Dixon became, you know, it was golden boot the year afterwards, you know, alongside of some bloke called Lineker. You know, it was David Speedy and I were scoring constantly together. He didn't play that day. Colin Lee played up front that day. I created one for him and I scored one myself. And scoring your first goal is a big thing. Because, you know, it has a slight weight off your shoulders. You know, okay, that's done. Right, move on now. And don't think about it again. But that was, suddenly the Chelsea fans were going, well, we've been watching Turgid Rap for the last 3 years. And then suddenly, they've got this team that flying forward, that's attack-minded, that's hard-working, that's very, very modern-looking, as opposed to the lump-up, long kind of teams that we're playing. With technically good players. And, you know, Speedo was an international, went out on to become an international. Teddy became an international. I became an international. We had Mickey Collins became an international. Probably was an international before that. And we had players all over the pitch that were just really, Nigel Spackman had turned out having a great career with Liverpool and then with Rangers and also with Chelsea as well. So suddenly for a team that had been really struggling nowhere, they basically brought in a bunch of internationals to be. One penny. And then suddenly we just started crunching people. The 5-0 game, I wasn't there. I'd come back up to Scotland to finish my finals because I had to sit them all for some of them. No, that's actually not true. Yeah, it's true. I had to sit some final exams. It was kind of shocking because I'd been to the World Youth Championships at the start of the summer. I missed my final exams at the end of second year. So I had to sit them all and reset. So I could miss the start of Chelsea C. And they were going, "What? You're doing your recess? But you've chopped the course." "Yeah, but I may have to go back. So I'm going to do my resets." So I went back and done the resets. And I got back on the Saturday morning, the Friday night, Saturday morning, I was up at Luton Reserves versus Chelsea Reserves. Well, the first team were up 5-0. But 5-6 weeks later, there are first team scoring. And we then go on an unbelievable trajectory after that, which nobody saw coming, including us. And certainly our fans. That day at Fulham you mentioned, it really sticks in my mind because a lot of Chelsea, the place was full, obviously, but a lot of Chelsea fans came along because they kind of seen a kind of inkling of something good, particularly with the start of the season with Derby, against Derby, who was supposed to be a good team. And then they saw that and they thought, not only are they pretty good, bloody hell, it's great promotion. And really just started then. That was the day it all started, where if you ask a lot of Chelsea, a certain age, and think they've been through a lot, you know, they've seen Champions League wins, or win the league, the John Terry's and Mazzola's and everything. A lot of them will say that's still their favourite season because of the unexpectedness and have a weird attitude. The joy of, thank God, we've just done it again, and we've won again. So and it surprised everyone. So, but and for me, oddly, I was just kind of enjoying it. Just I wasn't thinking, because I got in the first team, we were getting win bonuses, so I wasn't skint anymore. I could actually afford to go to gigs, and I could afford to eat. You know, I could afford to return that knife and fork that I nicked out of a Pizza Hut because I didn't have a knife and fork at home. So what was it? It's true.
I really good to have a Pizza Hut with a knife and fork.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that I didn't have any. I was so scared. So, but there I am. And it was 1 week where we played 3 games in a week and we won all 3 of them. So, and I think I'm. I can't remember. I mean, I might have made as much as I could and that is stuff. The records all get absolutely battled by a weekend. So I hammered them straight record and ran I want it. I mean, you know, I was just a student at heart still. So at that point in time, I'm having an absolute ball. And I'm really, really suddenly, slowly but surely, obviously the media down there began to think, because all they'd be entering, they'd spotted a young star had come down from Glasgow to sign for a top London club, right? But it wasn't me. It was Charlie Nicholas. He'd signed for Arsenal from Celtic. I came down the same week, nobody knows. And then suddenly they're going, well, actually, he's very different from Charlie. He's not like Charlie at all. There's the same pathway, but... And then they'd start seeing, they kind of meet you and you do some interviews and you'd be walking around the spot, you've got a Dostoevsky book in your hand as opposed to its son. And they're going, what? And I'm going, that's normal. Well, so a lot happened very, very quickly at that point in time. The team's doing well. And I'm in the team and I'm basically stuck there. That's me. I'm in totally to everyone's shock and surprise. And it starts well. And then it kind of, there's still a blip here and there, but it kind of keeps on going.
You had a trouble feeling wood in November. Was that maybe one of the most intimidating atmospheres you'd experienced at that point in your career?
Well, funnily enough, in Leeds United, that's a big one. I mean, I can't remember it as well, because you can't remember all your games you played it. But certainly I knew the Chelsea fans and Leeds fans hated each other. That was the biggest rivalry Chelsea had in those days. And it's not the case now, but it was the case then. The Chelsea-Leeds thing, 1970 FA Cup final, the hatred. I mean, and there were such opposites. You know, Leeds were a great team, but they were hard and they were nasty. And they were brutal. And Chelsea were King's Road stylish, cool. Just the absolute antithesis of each other. And North and South, all that stuff is, you know, political, no doubt, were different as well. So there was unbelievable hatred, and that hatred was palpable on the pitch and indeed in the stands and in the terraces. So there was trouble, you know, quite a lot of English football at the time, but you weren't going to get that game at that time without trouble. There was great trouble with that. But you had to concentrate in what you were doing, you know, because we wanted to win games. And certainly, you know, you talk about that game, but I actually jumped a wee bit further through the season. Well, ruin everything, but by the end of the season, we hammered them in again. Even I, who was like, you know, I'm Scottish, I'm not into all this sort of stuff, but even I, who just kind of come down, realized, isn't it great that we're doing it against them? And I don't have any bad feeling towards Leeds United now, but if you get anything off it then, with the way that both sets of crowds were, that would.
What do you remember about actually the result that got you promotion, that guaranteed you were up?
I kind of get mixed up with them, really. And that's the absolute truth of it. As I speak to you just now, because there was 2 games at the end of the season. So there was 3 games that were about 3 or 4. We beat Leeds 5-0. It was mayhem. Absolute and utter mayhem. Because, you know, 5-0, Stamford Bridge. I scored that day. But you won't see that on, if you look up online. It's just not, you can see it. Because what was there was, and the By the end of the game, about 20 minutes ago, all our fans had come onto the side of the track. It was a big track around Stamford Bridge and Lowestoke. And it was thousands and thousands and thousands. So none of the journalists could see what was going on. And I scored at the end of the game. I think they gave it to either Carnival or Kerry. But it was actually me that scored that. Yeah, goal. But at that time, my kind of head was slightly burst because I'm thinking, well, we're going to go up. We'd beaten Manchester City a couple of weeks before, or the week before, I think, 2-0 up at City. And this sums it up, right? Live on television, Friday night, BBC One. Huge number of people watching. Live football was very unusual then. Really unusual. Just didn't get it very often. And so it was a gigantic game. And Bobby Charlton was the pundit. And when I seen the recording afterwards, he was kind of so fantastic to me. I'd scored a good goal and I'd played well. And he'd say something like, you know, I reminded him of Matthews and Finney. And I'm thinking, well, we can't get much better praise than that from anyone. And if it's Bobby Charlton that's saying it, yes. So, you know, everything's going fantastically well. Of course, what I did after the game, it was at Main Road, as it was Manchester City at the time, what I did after the game was I did what everyone of my ilk would do. I didn't go home with a team. I went to a club in Manchester, and I didn't go to any clubs, but this club called the Hacienda was one that I fancied going in because my favourite bands, Joy Division and New Order and Joey Column, A Certain Ratio, were all on a factory record label. And then Hacienda was the factory club. And I went along and I got the 5 a.m. milk train back to London the next day after sleeping on a bench in the station. Instead of the night before, I'd been starring on television, beating Man City for Chelsea, scoring. All these fabulous things were just about, that's us up now, basically, just about up, you know, into the Premier League as it is, was now. And what did I do? I sleep on a bench in the train station.
Imagine if they had social media in those days, there'd be tons of things on Twitter, like, oh my goodness, that tramp looks like Pat Nevin.
Do you know what made me feel great? Years later, and I was about 3 or 4 years later, I was flying back up to Scotland once, and there was actually what looked like a tramp, or we'd call it a tramp, but that's, you know, it's almost messing with him, absolutely, lying on the floor at Heathrow Terminal 1. But beyond the kind of check-in, I'm thinking, well, how did you get a homeless person through? Can you have a ticket? Doesn't it work? And everyone's just stepping over this kind of homeless person. And I think, maybe, all right. So I went over and I woke him up and he's lying against the wall and come down. And it was a guy called Tom Waits. He was a fabulous, fabulous singer. And a great album called Swordfish Trombone, but an American kind of West singer. And I just thought, it's all right, I can move that hobo too. If Tom West can do that, I can do it. So it's actually all right to be. And the more important thing is, my dad hardly missed a game in my entire career. And that first season down at Chelsea, he was at almost every game. Certainly got to all the home games. But he had to get the late train home overnight a lot of the time. And I had to go straight to work in the morning. So if my dad can do it all the time, and he's a working man, you know, a labouring job with British Rail, why the hell can't I do it? So I've never changed that attitude. And I'm exactly the same that I know in a couple of weeks' time, I've got at least 2 nights where I have no sleep. I will not get to bed. I need to stay up all night and do something the next day because of work. That's fine. You can do that sometimes, and you should do that. It's not a complaint. You do it when it's the right thing to do it. And at that time, going to the Hacienda was the right thing. So it was great that. And by that time, at the end of the season, we beat Man City 2-0. I'm chancy here, and I'm trying to remember how they actually went. The most important game of the year had. And that was a 1-0 win against Crystal Palace, which we'll go back to in a moment. But so we beat Leeds 5-0 at Stamford Bridge. We beat Man City 2-0 away. And then it was a Barnsley game. And I think that was when it really jumped out. I scored 2 that day. And there was all sorts of wild, mad celebrations. And just absolutely joyous. And then could we know we're comfortable, we're up now, we're happy, we know we're going to the top league. It's now called the Premier League, then called the First Division. And can I just remember stopping that day and thinking, actually, this is all right. This is brilliant. And then we've been a joy to watch. I'd been given complete freedom by the manager. He just said, away and destroy them. Go on. Get the ball. Do it. When we lose the ball, you know what to do. As in, I was hard working. I have to be a distance runner as well, so I can run all day. So I'll get back into defensive position. But yeah, again, like Craig Brown, it's the manager, John Neal, who just said, there was another game during that season, and we beat Newcastle 4-0. And most Chelsea fans, if they talk about that season, that's the game they talk to me about. And on the F team was Kevin Keegan, Chrissy Waddle, Peter Beardsley, Henry McDermott. They were brilliant. They're a brilliant team. And we absolutely battled them outside. And I had this two agreements. One of them was with my dad, and one of them was manager. The first one with the manager was, if we ever get three goals ahead, I'm allowed to have fun. I'm allowed to just take the mess the wrong way, but do whatever I like. As in, get the ball and dribble just for the pure fun of it. And it's a weird thing to say, but I just like dribbling the table. That's beautiful. So just get it anyways. But I had to be 3-0 up. And anyway, this day we got 3-0 up, and the manager went, can I? Anyway, oh, right. Have your play time. And I just saw the ball. And I did this run this day where these Chelsea fans still talk to me about it. I ran the length of the pitch, dribbling, and done Keegan twice. Eventually, just missed putting Kerry Dixon in for a goal. And it was a very weird kind of, the whole place was just, wow, just what's going on here? This is just so much fun. The other reason why I did the dribble was because after every year I couldn't see my dad, because he had to rush back and get the train back up to Glasgow. So I agreed with my dad that every game in my career, I would go for one mad, mazy, stupid dribble just for the fun of it, to say, hi, Dad. It's a weird thing. I always thought that was normal. And then when I wrote about it too recently, people go, that's amazing, Aaron. I couldn't see my dad. He'd come all the way down from Glasgow and we're training all the way back up. So, hi, Dad. Perfectly reasonable way to say hi to me. I thought, anyway, so... And that day, after beating Newcastle, who were a big, strong side, we were obviously good players, and the Chelsea fans really took me to their heart from then on. And they knew not only that I was trying to be skillful and entertain them, but they also knew I was bloody hardworking. And that was a big difference, because you used to go back up to Scotland sometimes for Scotland games, and people would go, oh, just a tricky winger, you're just, you know, you're kind of an add-on, you know, someone... I'm thinking, I'm one of the hardest one people you'll meet, man. You know, but if they're not seeing you every week, if this vision of you from highlight. But the Chelsea fans realised that within our group, we were all had a brilliant attitude, all worked incredibly hard, and hopefully some talented players in there too.
Promoted in the top league gets you recognition, and rightly so, out by your country. And you were eventually called up to represent Scotland. What do you remember about your debut? And I'm going to show you something about talking with.
That does look like Romania. Yeah, that would be my first cap. Came on for...
That was my first Scotland game.
But you'd have seen Beckenbauer walking out with his big long trench coat, because he was giving Kenny a special award for his 100th cap that day. And the strange thing was, you know, so for me, it's an amazing thing. I mean, it's a couple of years later than, you know, this Chelsea. Because it was a hard team to break into. The Scottish national team, we had a lot of good players at the time. But I mean, my dad had always said to my brothers, and he always thought I would play in national football, and I thought it was off his head, really. Don't be stupid. What do you know? And of course, that day is the day he's able to sit and go, well, told you. Told my brothers when I was like 12 that he thought I'd be an international. But playing that day was amazing. You know, just to finish off the Chelsea's that 83-84 season, our last game of the season. So my dad was the reason I played. He taught me how to play. When I was playing, I loved the joy that it gave him as much as the joy that it gave me. he taught me everything of how to be a father and how to be a good human being, about ethics and everything. So my hero in many ways, right? The final game of that season, 83-84 for Chelsea, was the only game he didn't get in. And it's the day we won the league. I created the goal that won the league. I also missed a penalty. I created the goal that won the league, right? And it was at Grimsby away from home. And that was the only game we missed because my sister was getting married. Couldn't it come? A nightmare. So he missed that moment. So that had been the biggest moment in the career where we won the league that day at Grimsby, and he wasn't there. And he was there for lots of other big moments. But if you take two or three moments in your whole career of 19 years, one of them is your debut for your country. And my dad was there. And he was there that night against Romania. I came on his sub. And then after the game, I walked out. And typical Glaswegian again, you know. We did like, we obviously loved each other after, but I've got the shirt in the bag and I've got a plastic bag, probably a beer bag or something, you know, I just a poly bag. And I went, you better have this stuff. And I was like, you know, I'll slap my shirt cut. And it was a really poignant moment of, you were right all along. You knew what you're talking about. You taught me well, you coached me well. So it was a great, great day. Every time, I remember every time I got the ball when I come on, I just thought, where's Kenny? What are Kenny? The reason being, Kenny had scored the same amount of goals as Dennis Law, and we were all trying to get Kenny another goal. So, but we couldn't, we win the game, we beat Romania 3-0. Was Hadji playing that? I can't.
He was, paid, yeah.
Yeah. So, but we didn't care. We'd done them. We were a good team. We'd won. Now try and get Kenny his goal. And tries and rate, we just couldn't get Kenny his goal. So there's lovely memory of that. It could all come from that season where I started with Clyde and it all went incredibly well, incredibly quickly, incredibly unexpectedly. Then by pure accident, I end up going to Chelsea. And by the end of the first season at Chelsea, we've won the league. I'm in the team every week. Front three of me, Kerry and Spiro scored 60 odd goals between us, you know, in the league. It's unbelievable numbers. Three guys, 60 odd between. I mean, people think of Haaland and all that now, it kind of makes things different. But for then, that's weird. That was a weird number. And then I go, where were you? It was really easy because it came so quickly. And, you know, it gets hard when this thing goes on and it's not like always perfect as it goes on. But then a few years later to then become, you know, Scottish international, and slowly but surely that dream of going back and finishing the degree, you know, that faded away because I was doing other things and I was learning other things. It was brilliant. But that first season, if you're talking about the utter joy of it, the success of it, the friendships as well. To this day, I have to remember the Crystal Palace game. We've got 1-0. I refused to talk about it. I scored the winner. Wouldn't talk about the game afterwards to the press. Basically roared and bawled at the Chelsea fans who booed her blankly. This isn't acceptable. Nobody talked about it at the time. It was just, that was culture. And I said, no, I'm not having it. What that led to many years later is me getting two doctorates. So I'm Dr. Doctor now. Anyway, I don't ever use those doctorate things, by the way, except on one occasion, right? My daughter is a real doctor. And many times she annoys dad, I go, it's not dad, it's doc. Indeed, it's his doctor, doctor. She was. So there's kind of so many things happening. And that's only just crashing the surface of it. The friends I met became mates with people like John Peel. So many phenomenal things in London. Met so many phenomenal people. And just had a glorious, almost easy season. And knowing that the next season we're in the top league. And by the way, I'm wondering whether it'd be good enough. But we were, you know. We thought for the first couple of years after, we were like, oh, we were vying for the top place or the top two or three places. So it's extraordinary that all happened in such a short period of time. And it's kind of why it's kind of my favourite season. I wouldn't say it was my happiest season, by the way. That's two different things. You're talking about my favourite season, happiest was probably right at the end of my career with Kilmarnock. And I had a year at Kilmarnock. And it was just so much fun with such fun people. And I was back home in Scotland, and that's where I wanted to be. But it took me 16 years to get back, 15, 16 years to get back. And that was an unbelievably happy year. And we got European football and all that sort of stuff. And it was big for Kelly. But in reality, all the kind of adventures in between, and as I say, the two books that I've written about my career, and one of them turns out, the first one, Accident Football, was in the Sunday Times bestsellers, you know. And it's just, you couldn't have imagined that this wee scrawny wee 19-year-old, 18-year-old kid, bugs in at Chelsea with the weird, you know, things. But it's, I think the reason for it is you take all those chances, you work incredibly hard. It doesn't come easy. You have to work for things to happen. And also you accept your fortune, good fortune, happen. You've got to be lucky as well. And I sort of accept that good fortune every day.
Well, there's one adventure you haven't talked about yet, Pat, and that was your sojourn to Sweden in 1902. Tell us about what it's like to represent your country and heroes.
I'd kind of missed out a few, you know. 86, I was in the squad before we went to Mexico, dropped for the squad, and then in the squad right afterward. Tim Hamden, World Cups in 90. So, and considering all the English teams were banned for Europe at that time because of ISIL, you know, I wasn't. The international game was the only chance I had. So I really wanted to go to Euro 92. Managed to get on the plane and scored the winner in a sort of build-up game against the USA, which rather wonderfully, that goal is actually in one of my favourite movies, which is, do you know this? It's a movie called So I Married an Axe Murderer.
I know the film. Oh, is that the, all right, oh, brilliant, I know exactly.
You white ball. It's World Series of Soccer comes up in the background, and he's saying, "Heap, you know what I'm telling? That's my goal. We score against the USA. That's my claim to fame." So I got to the Euros. And annoyingly, I had a broken ankle. Broken tip when I got there because I got a bad, bad tackle in that American game. But I was able to run, I was able to dribble with the ball. There's a moment where we beat the CIS 3-0 in the third goal, and I get the ball in our own half, and I dribble the length of the pitch, and then dummy nets up or somebody, and go into the box and get tripped up. And it looks like great skill, except I can't pass the ball anymore 20 yards because my foot's so sore, so I need to dribble. I am dribbling all that distance. But it was great to be there. Unfortunately for us, yeah.
I'm going to have to interrupt, Pat. I'm sorry, but I watched that. I remember watching it live, and I thought, I'm going to have to go back and make sure my memory is correct. And I watched the highlights again. You were tackled in Sweden, but you ended up in Norway where you finished. You tumbled out the box. I have never seen such distance. Or in getting tackled. You went about 6 yards in the air.
What happened is, I kind of knew that they were tired. And I'll give you the technical reason for it, right? So I've run all that distance, right? And as I squared them up, we do you square a defender. See, if he squares you, you squared them. I'm goodbye. Simple as that. Because you can't turn quick enough. So all I need to do is make sure the ball goes by you, and I'll beat you, because you're squared off and can't move quickly enough. So that's what I got him into that position on the balls. So I dummied him and I squared him. So I flicked the ball past him. All I need to do is get past him. But he puts his leg up and I'm trying to go over him. I don't want to get right. I want to get by him. I don't want to get tackled. I want to get by him. And he puts his leg up further. That's horrible. That's right. You go over him and ends up a fly over him. And the reason being is, see, I can score. I can go by people. I never dive in my life. I never made the meal of anything. I'm trying to get by. And he's doing everything, he stopped me. Then it was like, he started shouting the referee, but said there wasn't a penalty. Ball, it was full shell. So, but the fans had come in such huge numbers. And there was a day, we went, you know, to the end of the game against CIS Russia. At the end of the game, I was walking off with Gary McAllister. And we're fed up because we've gone out. We've won 3-1. We've let the fans down as far as we're concerned.
Well, you haven't let us down, Pat, and that's all that matters. Although we are slightly concerned about your revelation that you eat pizza with a knife and fork. that brings us to the end of another episode of the CSI Football Podcast. Join us next week for another forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. Our website is at www.csi.com, where you can find all of our socials. But until next week, goodbye.